Well, thank you for those who came back, and some were not here for everything this morning. So far, we've talked about kind of the idea of what the Bible teaches about money and resources in general, and how the principles that we observe in our economy now actually were written up thousands of years ago in Scripture. You have supply and demand. You have problems with debt. You have work, and we've talked about then, well, how does the Bible teach we gather money? What is the formula? Hard work times skill produces wealth, and wealth gained hastily or attempted to be gained hastily generally results in loss. To patiently acquire skills and to work hard is how to gain success. And those who try to circumvent that harm themselves and others in the process. We talked about budgeting, Proverbs 21:5, the plans of the diligent lead to advantage. The one who is hasty comes to poverty. There's a lot of really good and practical things you can do to work on that. I'll mention, again, in terms of the things I've written about this, the one I haven't mentioned yet is PNR has these 31 days devotionals. There are like a daily bread, but a little bit more, on different topics: worry, pre-marriage, struggles with this, that, and the other. Well, I wrote the one on finances, which is kind of like a little mini version of this, where a couple pages a day going through the basics of what the Bible says about money, speaking to us on heart issues and devotionally. This is something, I did meet a professor's wife who read through it straight through at the beach. I generally don't think of this as beach reading. It's a bit like a manual, kind of like my marriage book, where you can look up certain things like, should I use debt to buy a vehicle? And there's a chapter about that. I want, you know, again, in terms of my focus, I want first of all to focus upon glorifying God in all that we do, our work, our spending, our saving. That's the focus. It's not being debt-free or being happy or successful or wealthy. And then I want everything we say to be backed explicitly by faithful exposition of the Word of God in a context of sound theology, which is where this may go a little further than other resources that are available on the market. I don't anticipate outselling Dave Ramsey, but I did say that, like, when Jim Dobson wrote about parenting, and then Ted Tripp came with Shepherding a Child's Heart, and it was kind of like a much more biblical. He sold over 1 million copies. I don't think I'm going to sell 1 million copies. But Dave Ramsey's written some nice practical things, but it's very shallow biblically. And so I'm trying to say here is a much more in-depth and maybe more nuanced approach. Also, to be careful to acknowledge our freedom, that we don't want to be legalistic in the sense of saying you must do these particular things when the Bible gives us freedom. And there are a lot of areas where they say, well, there are principles of wisdom, like we talked about. Even if you had a great deal of money, how much you spend, how much you save, and how much you give away, the Bible doesn't tell you exactly the parameters for that. You have to wrestle in your own conscience. And those of us who are well off, which is what Americans generally are, in the context of the world and of history, we are always living with tension in terms of, you know, God has given me this lifestyle, I'm free to enjoy it, and yet I'm aware there are needs, and sometimes I'm sacrificing lifestyle to meet those needs and preparing for the future. So you've got these things in tension. There's no quick and easy formula. As we'd started on debt, our other topics are debt and then preparing for the future. As a little teaser, when Carolyn and I counsel, we don't charge. And yet, one time I gave somebody advice in counseling that was worth literally $1 million. And I will explain how that happened before we're done today. So it may be worth $1 million to you when we get there. We'll see. I hope it won't be when you see what happened. But as we were talking about debt, interesting, a week ago I was in Medellin, Colombia in South America teaching the same material. And when I started talking about debt, especially debt among family members and friends and people in church, it was amazing how much their situation and our situation were in common in terms of some of the problems that we're all facing. The same thing, by the way, was true. We got down to investments and cryptocurrency and speculation and things like that. debt produces bondage. We've already read Proverbs 22, verse 7. The borrower becomes the lender's slave. A while back, I had charged something large that was on my credit card statement. I think you're free to have credit cards so long as you pay them off every month. I think if you don't pay them off, you're enslaved, then it's going to be tough. But one time I had a large charge and I had $7,000 on my statement. I had money in the bank. I paid it immediately. But on the credit card statement, it said, if you make the minimum payment each month on the $7,000, how long do you think it would take to pay the whole thing off? 28 years. And I will have paid over $14,000 when it was over. And of course, the problem is people with credit cards, you don't leave it at $7,000. You know, that keeps bumping up. And it's a cycle of slavery because the money you're spending on the interest is totally non-productive money. It's not buying food. It's not buying gasoline. It's money just going away for nothing. One of the best things that can happen financially in your life is actually when Dave Ramsey, I'm debt-free. But I mean, to own everything debt-free, you have more money to spend, to give, to save, to enjoy lifestyle. And so debt, it is tempting in terms of I can enjoy immediate gratification rather than having to wait. But in the long run, it's going to cost you more. A debt can presume upon the future. In the mind of a man, he plans his way, but the Lord directs his steps. Sometimes people say, well, I'm going to get a raise, or this other money's going to be coming in, and then it doesn't happen. Often we get into debt because we're not content. I've got to have this thing now. You know, the car I have now is old, and it doesn't sound very good, and there you go. Again, debt is hard to get rid of. And again, I already said, in the long run, debt lowers your standard of living rather than raising it. And we talked before the break about government debt, which leads to inflation, which then steals from people who have saved their dollars and are losing it. Businesses becoming highly leveraged are at great risk. And then individuals and families, you know, go through bankruptcy or other great problems. So to try to live a lifestyle by which you, what you buy is determined by what you have or what you're earning and not by your credit limit. In the 1910 Sears catalog, there was a statement, buying on credit is folly. Now they changed their minds and now they're out of business, by the way. Actually, largely due to debt. Interesting proverb, Proverbs chapter 3, verses 27 and 28. Says, do not withhold good from him to whom it is due when it is in your power to do it. Do not say to your neighbor, go and come back. Tomorrow I will give it to you when you have it with you. And that's a broad statement of wisdom. And it's kind of like you don't want to owe stuff to people. You want to pay it quickly. And then I can't tell anybody not to have a credit card. But in Matthew 5:29, Jesus says, if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and throw it from you. It's better to go to heaven without an eye than to go to hell with both eyes. And this is, again, it's applied that if you have a trouble with drinking inappropriately, don't keep a bunch of beer and wine around the house. If you have struggles with use of screens or bad things on the screens, then you take things out of your life to protect you from sin. Well, some people really struggle with the need for instant gratification and the thought that things will make them happy, and the best thing they can do would be not to make debt easily accessible to them. Back in the old days, some people talked, they had an envelope system where you get your cash for the month and you put it in the envelopes and you spend it that way, so you can't spend what you don't have. I think you can have kind of your own electronic envelope system where you have categories in your budget and you're spending what you have and you don't spend what you don't have. Broad general principle regarding debt would be don't ever put yourself in a position or do everything you can possibly do to avoid putting yourself into a position where you owe more on something than you could sell it for quickly. Does that make sense? Before the bizarre events of the last couple of years, cars would be a great example, right? Where you'd go buy a car for $28,000 and you'd get it home, and if you wanted to sell it back, you would get $25,000 for it at best because it was now a used car. I mean, now used cars are, because of inflation and all kinds of weird things temporarily. You've got this bizarre thing going on. But I've counseled people who had bought a car they couldn't afford. They've got payments they can't afford. They're trying to bring down their expenses. It'd be a wise thing to buy a cheap beater car and survive with that for a while instead of the $350 car payment. The problem is they owe thousands of dollars more on the car than they can sell it for, so they're stuck. Something similar happens to people with houses where they say, okay, I'm going to put 5% down. And then the housing market takes a dip for 20%, which happens, by the way, I'm not a prophet, but after the thing going up, how much of your houses have you owned a house gone up in the last couple of years? 40% or something? I've told the story before lunch. You know, we watched in California massive dips of 40% or more up and down. And so if you're upside down, you know, so with a house, the world would say, buy all the house you can, minimize your down payment. You'll hear even people say, well, even take equity out of your house and you can invest it and make more money. That's all increasing risk. We'll talk about that more with the investment part. My ideal would be you want to have enough equity in your house that if you had to move for a job or whatever reason you needed to get out of the house, you wouldn't be upside down and owe the bank more money than you could get for it. So you're minimizing the use of debt. Another example would be borrowing money for education. I can't say it's sinful to do that. Some of it depends on the education you're getting. We use the $15 an hour Chick-fil-A person. Let's say this person is very skilled with computers and he can spend several thousand dollars on a course which will get him a certification, which will enable him to be worth $25,000 or $30,000 in the marketplace. Well, that could be a good investment because he has that debt, but the amount of money he expects to earn will pay that debt off in a year or two and he'll have that leveraged earning. His skill level will have increased. Classic example would be medical school. I mean, people sometimes are six figures in debt after medical school, but once you start working as a doctor, you're making enough money where you can eliminate that debt before too long. On the other hand, I've met people who went to college and majored in the liberal arts and then went to seminary, and they come out of seminary, and for what you can get in ministry, you could have made close to that right out of high school, perhaps, in some cases. And so they've incurred debt that their education has not equipped them to pay off. And so I can't tell you from the Bible you're not allowed to borrow money for a liberal arts degree. I can't tell you if you get a liberal arts degree that you're not going to be the one who gets a PhD and teaches at Harvard and makes $200,000 a year for doing so. I can tell you debt is something we should hate. It'd be like, it's like weeds in the garden. It's like mice in the garage. It's like, I don't want to have this stuff. I want to try to get rid of it if I do have it, rather than just saying, hey, I'm going to go do whatever I want to do and not worry about the debt later. And of course, again, I don't want to make too many political comments, but you know, when people have voluntarily taken on debt for education, and then they don't want to pay it back, you know, they made those decisions. They may have been foolish decisions. Psalm 15, verse 4 says, the righteous man swears to his own hurt and keeps his word. But of course, part of it would be in our own families to say we want to avoid taking on debt we don't need. One of the specific warnings in Scripture is against co-signing. Proverbs chapter 6, beginning in verse 1. My son, if you become surety for your neighbor, have given a pledge for a stranger, if you've been snared with the words of your mouth, have been caught by the words of your mouth, do this, my son, and deliver yourself, since you have come into the hand of your neighbor. Go humble yourself and importune your neighbor. Give no sleep to your eyes nor slumber to your eyelids. Deliver yourself like a gazelle from the hunter's hand, like a bird from the hand of the fowler. Again, general principle, and this is something actually that in our church in San Diego, we had a lot of people, immigrants from certain places, and it was just expected that if you had credit, you would help family members buy a car by co-signing their loans, or you would help family members buy a house by co-signing on their house, on their mortgage. I can't tell you from the Bible you're not allowed to do that. I can tell you the Bible says that's usually a very foolish thing. Quite frankly, if the bank has looked at your relative or your friend's credit situation and they say, we will not give you this loan without you have a co-signing person, what has the bank concluded? They can't afford this. This is an extremely high-risk loan. We do not want to take that risk. We want somebody else to take that risk, that person being you. And for your relative to put you in that position to say, the bank won't lend me the money, but I want to do this for my business or for my car or for my house. Again, I can't say to you, you're doing evil by doing this. I can tell you, you're probably being unwise in most situations. In some cases, they want something they really can't afford. They want the car they can't afford, and rather than saving money and living frugally, their impatience to have something immediately, you're enabling that. You're enabling them to take on more debt than they can afford. Or even they've been living irresponsibly, which is why they're in this bad situation, and you're kind of continuing the cycle of instant gratification. And of course, the more vivid passage is Proverbs 22, verses 26 and 27. It says, do not be among those who give pledges, among those who become guarantors for debt. If you have nothing with which to pay, why should your bed be taken from underneath you? Isn't that a vivid picture? There you are lying in your bed, you co-signed a loan, and suddenly you're on the ground because they just snatched your bed. I've actually heard people complain like, well, I co-signed this thing, my kid's student loan, and I co-signed, and now they want me to pay the money. Like, that's what you signed. That's the bad promise you made. So the scripture warns against that practically. It's dangerous. And then like unto that would be the risk of becoming entangled with family members, lending them money. Again, let's say you've been responsible and you've saved some money and now they want to buy something or they're in financial trouble. They touch you up for a loan. If you love me, you would do this for me. Furthermore, if I had money, I'd lend you money. If you had a problem, why can't you do that for me? You've just been lucky in life. And one of the things I was facing in Medellin last weekend is in these close family relationships, how do you say no under those circumstances when this is just expected? And one aspect would be if God has so blessed you that you can afford to lose that much money, be it co-signing or making the loan, and you want to do that, you're free to do that. There are even verses that commend people who lend to others in great need. So if you have a family member and their business got wiped out by COVID or they've been temporarily disabled and unable to work and they've had calamity and you want to help them in their calamity, that could be a very good thing, to lend them or to give them money you may never see again. That can be a godly thing to do. But don't do it if you expect to get the money back. But another aspect would be Proverbs 29:25 says, the fear of man brings a snare, but the one who trusts in God will be exalted. And the issue has to be, what as best I can tell would God have me to do in this situation? And it's not a matter of pleasing my family. I need to please God. And if God has made me a steward of my resources and God has made me responsible to provide for my family, well, if some irresponsible family member is putting pressure on me and maybe using other family members to put pressure on me to put my family's finances in jeopardy, that's probably a decision that doesn't please God. And I'm going to have to say I must obey God rather than men, or I must follow the wisdom of Scripture and say, I care about you, but I can't in good conscience do what you're asking me to do. And my expectation would be the short-term consequences of them being upset with you may be less severe than the long-term consequences of you being liable for their debt or you, them never paying you back, and the years of bad relationships that will create. I, by the way, am speaking not merely from scriptural knowledge, but from personal knowledge as I say these things. I mentioned earlier that when I was young, in my 20s, we were in Saudi Arabia. I was making a lot of money working for an oil company while I was pastoring a church, and family members found out, people found out we had saved some money, and they persuaded us. And here's what the verse in Proverbs, remember, the borrower becomes the lender's slave. The worst thing that I've seen, and this is actually something I think Dave Ramsey has observed, is from the same verse, is that when people owe you money and they don't pay you back, or you have to pay off their debt, Who's most angry? They're mad at you. That nobody wants to feel like a slave. And so, and also I think they're anticipating that this person is judging me and they think they're better than I am and they're judging my lifestyle and they see how much I eat out and because I'm not paying them back or so they resent you because you're the lender and they're the borrower, you're the master, they're the slave. And so what you thought would make the relationship better in the long run actually made it worse. Do as I say, not as I did. but that's a warning. But again, if you do it, just be prepared to lose your money. If you do it, be prepared for damaged relationships. And we've even had situations where we just said, we just want to forget the debt. We're okay. It's between you and the Lord. We're done. Just to be done with it. So just beware. Again, these are wisdom principles. I've already mentioned about the buying a home or borrowing for education. We talked a little bit about borrowing for a business, that I can't tell you can't borrow money for a business. I can say my advice would be to minimize how leveraged your business is, to maximize equity in the business, because the more you borrow, the greater there will be risk. Just like we get to investing, the more return you demand, the greater the risk will be. Well, the more you borrow, the greater the risk to your business or to your family. Another question that comes up on borrowing would be, on debt, would be, is a Christian ever allowed to declare bankruptcy? And Psalm 37, verse 21 says, the wicked borrows and does not pay back. There's actually something going on right now in my state where the owner of a sports franchise who is a billionaire was in a joint venture that didn't go well, and the joint venture is declared bankruptcy even though the billionaire isn't affected by that. It was all his doing, but he was able to structure things in a way that other people are caught holding the bag. Manipulating the system to avoid paying the legitimate debts you've incurred, Psalm 37 says that's wicked. To try to figure out a way not to pay off your debts is wrong. Now, there are some people who get forced into bankruptcy and they have no options. COVID has wiped out your business, or maybe even you made some unwise decisions and there's just no way you can keep up the payments. It's interesting in Proverbs 6, so it talks about being surety for debt. It says go beg. There's nothing stopping you from saying, can we lower the interest rate? Can we reduce the payments? But a Christian is a person who will strive with everything he can to pay off his debt, not to try to manipulate the system to protect his assets while walking away from debt. That's part of our integrity, that our standard is higher than the law. But there will be, again, I've used the example, there are businesses that might have been wiped out by COVID or hailstorms or other things through history. We're not sovereign. We don't know the future, and we don't control anything in the present or the future. And so we can find ourselves in situations where we owe debts we can't pay. Some people have medical bills they can't pay. So sometimes a Christian may be forced into bankruptcy. Some Christians were forced in the last housing crisis to walk away. They owe $600,000 on a house that now is worth $350,000. And they've lost their job, they can't keep making the payments. I said, the bank, here it is, it's yours. And I'm not saying you're not allowed to do that. I would say you want to avoid putting yourself in that position so far as you can. I'd also say that for Christians, our standard is higher than simply the letter of the law. I had a friend who many years ago had a business, and various circumstances led to that business going bankrupt, and so his debts were discharged in court. And many years later, the Lord prospered this man in a new business. And he actually went back to those to whom his first business had owed money and paid them back what he owed them, even though he had no legal obligation to do so. And he said that when he went, some of these companies, they didn't know what to do. They didn't have a place in their accounting system to put the money from the return, of 8 years ago, this debt was discharged, and now I'm giving you a check for $15,000 for what I owe you that I never paid you. But so we as Christians want to be people who avoid putting ourselves in position where we can't pay things off, and we want to pay our debt so far as we are able, even if, you know, the person who bought the house for $600,000 and now it's worth $350,000, he's sorry he made that decision, but to say, well, I'm just going to walk away because I don't want to be making a $600,000 payment on a $350,000 house, that may not be, again, there are details in different situations, but that may not be a moral decision if you have the resources by which you can meet the promise you made. You signed a contract. Psalm 15, verse 4, the righteous man swears to his own hurt and keeps his word. So you made a promise. We want to be those people. Sometimes we can't because we're not all powerful. There's a section about, well, what do you do when you get out of, how do you get out of debt? Part of it, if you're in debt, you do radical things. You radically slash expenses. You work extra. You work overtime. You acquire new skills. And so you sell stuff. You get godly counsel. The Dave Ramsey, I'm debt-free. That is a great position to be in. There are some tough questions. Generally speaking, don't borrow money from one source to pay off other debts. Don't keep borrowing just to continue the cycle. Some people say, well, if I owe a lot of money, should I be giving to the church? And that's also kind of complicated. But, you know, if you're about to go bankrupt, and I've even heard of people doing this, well, I'm about to go bankrupt anyway, so I'm going to give all my cash to the church, and then the creditors won't be able to get it. That doesn't sound like a moral decision either. I think for people who are in debt, probably they're going to, part of the consequence of your debt is, as wonderful and happy as it is to give to the Lord's work, you've driven yourself into a ditch and you can't afford to do much. I still think to do something would be good, but obviously if you can get the debt paid off, then you can be much more generous in the future. One of the biggest problems you have in many families is a spouse who will not control their spending. You have one spouse who's trying to be responsible, another spouse who keeps spending and running up the credit cards, and that can be a counseling issue. It can even be a church discipline issue if it gets to a certain point. One spouse running up debts the other spouse doesn't know about. I've had a case where the wife comes, drags her husband in, and the husband has run up a massive credit card bill. He wasn't working. She thought he was working, and instead he was engaging in speculative ventures that just lost more money. And she's getting phone calls now from credit collection agencies about, so that's not just a money problem, that's a relationship problem, that's a trust problem. And the relationship problem, both in terms of with the Lord and integrity and idolatry, and then with the spouse in terms of trust, those need to be addressed before you can solve the debt problem. The last broad category is preparing for the future. Proverbs 22, verse 3 says, the prudent sees the evil and hides himself, but the naive go on and are punished for it. Proverbs 21, 5, again, the plans of the diligent lead to advantage. And so there can be wisdom to saving for the future. Some people say, well, I'm going to work until I die. You don't know that. I mean, that's my intention, that if I would like to keep working the rest of my life and to be fruitful, but I don't know if I'll be physically able to do my work. I don't know if I'll be mentally able to do my work. I might get Alzheimer's or something. And so it's likely that most of us will need resources for retirement in the future. And so you can go back to Genesis with Joseph and the seven, you know, the fat cow years and the skinny cow years, is that someday, you know, there are going to be times when savings will be important to you. Obvious example is retirement. A day may come when you can't make much money anymore by working. It's probable that day may come. So rather than waiting until you're 69 to figure that out, you forego spending when you're 20s and 30s and put that money away and invest it so that when time comes to retirement, you're not a burden to your family or to the church. Family is meant to be a backstop. 1 Timothy 5, that widows should have children or grandchildren who take care of them before we go to the church for help. But again, it's a loving act towards your family members to prepare yourself for that if you can. Right now, a lot of people are talking about a recession. I don't know if there's going to be a recession soon. There will be one someday. There may be a great recession or depression or the things. And so again, there can be wisdom to saying, I can't assume I'll always have money. I can't assume I'll always have a job. And so, and Dave Ramsey does a good job with this, where you have emergency funds. And again, so he talks about having 3 to 6 months of reserve on hand. So if you were to lose your job or disaster strikes, you don't lose your house and you're able to weather the storm. How do you do that? Well, by the blessing of God. But part of it is, as money comes in, you say, rather than spending this on consumption and, boy, now I can afford the phone and eating out and the nicer car, you know, I'm going to continue to live a frugal lifestyle so I can put money away, because trouble will come someday. Some expenses, you know they're going to happen. You know your car is going to wear out. You know your air conditioner is going to need replacement someday, as I learned. You know events will take place. So there's wisdom to being prepared for the future, both for calamity, but also for just known events in the future. And then there are possible events in the future. This is my million-dollar advice. This is a note sent to me by a widow. And the situation, it was somebody I actually worked with at Masters for a while, Masters University. And then later he went to teach at Brooks College. He's about Josh Henson's age. His name is Joshua. He was a dear friend. And when I went to teach for him a few years ago, I stayed with him and his family. And he has 5 little boys. And while I was there about 3 years ago, I asked him, do you have life insurance? You've got these 5 little boys. You have a wife. And they hadn't really thought about it. And I just mentioned that. I don't even remember mentioning it. But the reason I know I mentioned it is because his widow, because about a year after I saw him, he was diagnosed with a rare form of cancer, and he died a few months ago. His widow wrote me a note, personal note, saying, I've been meaning to reach out to you and thank you for encouraging Joshua to get life insurance many years ago. Because of your push, he got life insurance, which is the means the Lord is providing for us after Joshua's homegoing. So that's the million-dollar advice I was talking about. And I would say for a young man, that would be about the right amount. And it can be purchased pretty cheaply. Now, again, God can provide in other ways. But in the culture in which we live, insurance is a way of spreading risk. Now most of us are required to get health insurance of some kind, but you know, you don't want to be in a position where you owe $1 million for something. Actually, I'm supposed to have a heart procedure. Well, Thursday I had a minor heart thing that probably was $20,000 or $30,000 ticket price. I'm going to have another one in July that I've done it before, and it was over $100,000. I'm really thankful I have health insurance. That would really mess me up to have to have debt like that or have bills like that. And so there are things we can do, be it liability insurance, and some of these things now you're almost required to do. But for your home, if you have a mortgage, your mortgage company requires that. But there are things you can do spreading risk that when calamity comes, if calamity comes, that risk is spread among others. And you know, the best thing, you know, the best money I've never paid off for would be having life insurance for the last 40-something years that I've never collected on. I don't regard that, you know, somebody else got the money, and that's fine. That's a bet I'm glad to lose. I bet I'd die, they bet I'd live, and they won, and good for them. But it was also something very important to me that if something happened to me, that Caroline could finish raising our kids. And part of the objective, by the way, would be you save enough money so that by the time you're in your 60s and you have a heart condition, you don't need the life insurance anymore because you've been saving for retirement and your family could live on that. So, but again, how do you do that? Well, you don't take as many fancy vacations. You keep your cars longer. You make decisions to save with wisdom for the future. Another thing I talk about is encouraging people to make a will. That's another possible calamity. I'll often ask a young couple, well, Who would raise your children if something happened to the two of you? You're out on date night and a meteor hits the movie theater or whatever, or a terrorist comes in or something, and your kids are home with a babysitter and now you're dead. It's a lot for them to deal with, but who is going to take care of them? And do you want some court deciding? Do you want your family members fighting about this? Maybe your family members aren't believers and you have Christian friends that if that happened, you'd want them to take care of your children in the future. You can go onto Costco.com and get an Intuit will maker for less than $100 and make some of those specifications. You know, just like even if something happened to all of you, where would you want your money to go? Would you want it to go to ministry? Or you can make those provisions, and those things will happen sometimes. And so being part of the general tenor of the book of Proverbs is wisdom in being prepared for the future. That's also gathering little by little savings we've talked about. And then I want to make a few comments about investing, and then we'll have some time for questions. General principle on investing, a couple general principles. One is risk and reward almost inevitably go together. That right now, if you want to buy a treasury note, which is government paper, or put money in, if you put money in a savings account, you're lucky right now to get just under 1% return, which is really sad because inflation is 8%, which means you're losing 7%. But at the end of the year, at least in dollars, you had $1,000, now you have $1,010 a year from now, which will buy you $900 worth of stuff. Okay, that's low risk. You can buy stocks, higher risk, but stocks can crash and could go down to half their value, or whatever can happen. But investing in a business, risk is not wrong or bad. General principle would be money you may need soon, money you can't afford to lose, you put in low risk stuff and you live with a low reward. That the money you need to pay for college next year, you do not want in Tesla stock right now, or cryptocurrency, because it has gone way down, and things go up and down. You'd want something more stable. If you're looking towards retirement 30 years from now, you can put a higher risk of stocks or equities or something like that with anticipation. It goes up and down. You can ride it out and do well. So the longer term, the higher risk you can afford. But you also want to make sure that the return you're being promised or the return that's hoped for, anticipated, is commensurate with the risk you're taking. Sometimes you can take a lot of risk for not much reward. I've done that. lend money to somebody for their business, and so they'll pay you the bank rate if they can pay you, and if they don't pay you, you lose everything. They can make a lot of money on the business. You can lose a lot of money or get your money back. Not a good investment, says I. If somebody tells you that they can give you a very high rate of return without risk, run as fast as your feet will carry you. If somebody says, and I've seen these cases so many times, and it goes into the church, and even I've seen churches where somebody comes into the church and they're an investment advisor. And by the way, I like investment advisors, some of them, but there are some that aren't very scrupulous. And they say, I can get you 9% completely safe. So if you've got $100,000 at the bank, I can get you $90,000 a year or $9,000 a year on that money completely safe. He is lying. If there was a surefire 9% return on $100,000, Warren Buffett, investment bankers who control billions of dollars, they'd all be on that. And by the way, that would then bring down that rate of return because it would be in demand. There's risk somewhere. Where is the risk? And so watch out for that. Actually, I'm going to give you, there's one little glitch in the system right now that you may not be aware of where you can get over 8% return with virtually no risk. Does anybody know what it is? I-Series savings bonds, and that's a government anomaly. They mess things up in all kinds of different ways. But the government has created savings bonds where you can buy $10,000 per person per year. You can go on the Treasury Direct website and link it to your bank account. And right now, those bonds are designed to pay the rate of inflation plus like 1% or 2%. And so if you have $10,000 saved, you can put that in there, and after a couple of years, if you don't like the return, if inflation drops down to zero, which I think is as likely as a snowstorm today, but if that were to happen, you could take your money out if you're not satisfied with the return you're getting and get most of it back after a couple, you know, there's very little penalty even if you take it out early. But that's a little anomaly. The problem is most of us need more than $10,000 for our retirement. It's like where you can put some of your savings and park it at least to get a little return, but it's not, you know, most people for retirement are going to need six or seven figure numbers, which that will not accommodate. It's a little anomaly in the system. Those are exceptionally rare. Generally speaking, risk increases with reward, and there are many people who will promise you high reward, and they will not fully inform you of the risk. One of the worst things that happened during one of the housing booms in California is investment salesmen would come into churches and say, look, you own a house worth $700,000. You only owe $300,000 in the house. Take $400,000 out, and I will show you how you can invest it, and you're paying 4% interest or 5% interest on the money you took out, but I'm going to make you 20% or 15%. Okay? You know who's making money? The guy who sold you the investment, which is another principle. Figure out how the person advising you makes his money, and often they are incentivized to sell you what makes them the most money. But in every one of these situations, and I've looked into many, when people come, oh, I've got this deal where this guy's convinced me to take this money out, I'm going to pay 5% interest on the money I took out, and then he's going to make me 12%. Well, he also can lose you 12% or lose you 20%. Or you find out that you can't access your money for 10 years without huge penalties because he's bought an annuity. And so, again, back to the debt thing. There are few things better in life than being completely debt-free. You know, right now, to pay off your house is 100% certain return of whatever interest you'll be paying for the rest of your life on that house. It is as safe as can be. Yes, you might be able to take that money and make more money on it, but you also might lose a bunch of the money. You're free to do what you want to do, but watch out. Risk and return go together. Watch out how people are making, you know, the people who are advising you are making their money. Some investment advisors will say, we're going to charge you 1% of your like retirement assets a year, and then we're going to invest it according to this philosophy. At least that's straightforward. Some do a straight fee. Pay me $1,000 a year, and I will advise you. When they're selling you stuff and they're making a commission on that stuff, that's where I can't say it's wrong or sinful, but you need to understand it. One other general principle. Don't invest in something you don't understand. This is how doctors especially seem to lose all the money they make. I'm going to avoid taxes, I'm going to invest in this limited partnership of shale oil in West Texas, and it's going to avoid taxes, and all they do is get in trouble and lose their money in many of these cases. This is where cryptocurrency, for me, I've tried to read a lot about it. I shared with Josh yesterday a quote by Warren Buffett that he wouldn't give $25 for all of the Bitcoin in the world. I would give you $25 and I'd sell it immediately for all the Bitcoin in the world. But there's a Bitcoin to me, by the way, is like gold is for my generation. Bitcoin is for the millennials what gold is for us. It's like they see that dollars are unstable. They see the government is irresponsible. They don't trust the government. Here's something that's not controlled by the government that I can put my resources in that I might have hope of, you know, more stability or something like that. But again, it's complicated with blockchain and this, that, and the other, and people explain, but there's no asset. Even gold is something physical. There's no asset, there's no government. It's very risky. It's worth what the next guy will pay you for it, but there's no guarantee there will ever be anybody that will pay you anything for it, as opposed to owning land, metals, commodities, or even cash issued by governments, even though they're inflating it. Generally speaking, the Zimbabwe thing doesn't happen all the time. So that would be broad advice, which gets back to, in my view, investing to gain a return by investing in a business that's producing goods and services that benefit others is a legitimate way to make money. Trying to trade in and out, trying to outsmart other people who are trading in and out, to me, is not a wise way to make money and probably will, in the long run, cause you to lose money. I've already kind of covered that. A lot of that is with the cryptocurrency. If you buy, you're just hoping that the next group of people will be willing to pay more than you were for this, not that there's actually a business or an asset behind this that you believe in. And so those are some risks. And again, I'm sure we've had some. It's interesting, the Bible even talks about bad investments. Ecclesiastes 5:13. There is a grievous evil which I have seen under the sun, riches being hoarded by their owner to his hurt. When those riches were lost through a bad investment, and he fathered a son, there was nothing to support him. So bad investments 3,000 years ago. These people have been around a long time. So beware. Another broad principle I would make would just be diversification. I don't know what the stock market's going to do. I don't know what commodities are going to do. I don't know what real estate's going to do. It's like sow your seed in the morning, sow it in the afternoon. You don't know what's going to bear fruit in Ecclesiastes 11. By the way, I use that for unemployment as well. Your job, if you're not employed, is to get a job. I'm going to make another comment going back that I forgot to make, that if you need a job, pray for a Boaz. Some of you following that? In Ruth chapter 2, you have, in the days of the judges, are the days of the judges, you think a young widow would be happy to go out into the fields among all the people harvesting? Or would that be kind of a dangerous thing? Are you going to expect the men who own the fields to welcome you to come gleaning? Because they all love the law and follow the law? Very dangerous time. Ruth goes out to glean, which is God's welfare system under the Old Covenant, and God provides a place where she can work and make enough to provide for herself and her family. That's what we need, is God's provision. As we, you know, yes, we have the duty to go out and to search, but we need, of course, she needed a Boaz for other reasons in chapter 3 and chapter 4, but in chapter 2, you know, if we need God to give us ways of providing. It's not all within our power to accomplish these things, and if the Lord can provide a Boaz for Ruth, he can provide work for those who need it. So, and I think with investment, get advice from people who are wise, who are good with money, and who don't have a vested interest in the advice they give you in terms of they're going to make money off of the decisions you make. It's hard to be objective if you're in that position. So to summarize, before we take a break and take questions, two spiritual principles. One will be that we should make it our goal to be wise and not rich. Proverbs 8:10, wisdom is better than jewels, and all desirable things cannot compare to her. So we live in a world which is promoting the lie, bought into the lie, that money and the things it buys is the key to happiness. That is idolatry. It is not going to work. Ecclesiastes 5, he who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves his abundance with its income. That too is vanity. When I was living in Saudi Arabia, I saw people who had worked sometimes all their lives and barely made ends meet, and then they went to Saudi Arabia. And when I went to Saudi Arabia, I got paid like triple my former income, tax-free and free housing for 6 years. And I saw how it affected other people in terms of they spent, they vacations, oriental rugs, they just crazy spending money, they were no happier. It didn't, and they often wasted all the money anyway. So that's not what's going to make you happy. Seek God's kingdom, be content. And then my favorite money verse is in the context of Paul appealing to the Corinthians to give generously to the needs of the believers in Judea. And it's 2 Corinthians 8:9, and there's such irony in this because what was the most foolish thing Proverbs said you could do in money matters? To be surety for the debt of somebody else. To co-sign. To take on the debt of somebody else. And yet, 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 9, for you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, for your sake he became poor, that you through his poverty might be made rich. And so, you know, Paul is describing how we owed a debt we could not pay. And Christ willingly took on our debt. He became surety. Some of the old language of the Puritans, the old hymns, talk about he willingly took on our debt and paid our debt for us, even though we incurred it through our own sinfulness and foolishness. But then it's even better than paying the debt because it says that you through his poverty might be made not just debt-free, not just to wipe out the debt, but his righteousness has been imputed to us. Our guilt was counted to him. He paid the debt. His righteousness is counted to us. And Paul uses that to give us perspective on financial matters in 2 Corinthians chapter 8. He's saying, when you're thinking about helping the needy people in Judea, remember what Christ has done for you and what really matters. And so as we walk in his steps, that's a motivation, not under compulsion, but willingly and cheerfully to give as we've received. By the way, sometimes we did not deserve it, to be gracious in our giving. And it's a privilege of being Christ-like, is to use the resources God has given us to be a blessing to others. So it's time for a break, and then we'll come back at the top of the hour.
Yeah, top of the hour.
And then you can ask me any question you want, and I may or may not be able to answer it.
Testing, testing, 1, 2. All right.
Oh, I was going to show you, so I'm glad you brought that up. Like, this is...
in our crowd. I was going to mention a couple of the books on the table. The most recent thing I've written is this little tiny book, How to Love Difficult Parents. And I've written about parenting in general, that parenting is more than a formula. I've written about rebellious kids and dealing with your adult kids. But this is the first book I've written my kids may read. The kinds of issues that come up. We have actually a lot of really wonderful 30-somethings in our church who are having real challenges with their parents being irresponsible financially, not honoring the rules of the grandkids, doing foolish things otherwise. How do you manage difficult relationships? So it should be a bigger book, but that's all the words they gave me. Anyway, so how many, does anybody have any questions that you want to ask? This may be really short. Yes.
Are we coming up to the microphone? Or?
They want you to come to the microphone. Sorry, I don't know the protocol, so I...
So I graduate college in about a year. What would be your general advice financially, specifically maybe like housing, to a graduate from school?
Okay. What did you major in?
Engineering.
Sounds like a good thing. Do you have a job, or do you have a job lined up?
Not yet.
Yeah. So, married? Are you married? About to get married?
No.
Okay. There's a verse, Proverbs 24:27, prepare your work outside and make it ready for yourself in the field. Afterwards, build your house. There's like a verse in the Bible that addresses the question as a point of wisdom. And so I can't tell you what, first of all, like a lot of questions people ask in counseling, you give me a stick figure and I would need a three-dimensional movie that would go on for a long time before I knew all the specifics of the situation. But it seems like get a job, establish your job, pay down debt. If you have debt, save some money. But I can't say don't buy a house or don't, you know, right now it's going to be really hard to buy a house, for example, but you can hope that a better day will come. Right now you're at a peak. The peak of prices has arrived simultaneously now with the interest rates almost doubling. But, you know, get a job where you can take the skills you've gained and maximize your income, and then pay off debt and save, and look for a wife, if I were you. But that's another thing just about marriage. There are a lot of young men who would love to be married and aren't nearly prepared to actually take care of a family. So if you want to get married and you're lonely, work hard and work smart so that you can be able to fulfill those responsibilities. Sounds like you're on track. We had other hands. A follow-up? Yes.
I'd like to know, for estate planning purposes, perhaps, and it was a good thing you mentioned about insurance. I was wondering, regarding that, it's kind of an aside to it, but I was wondering about, could you go over the differences between a will, a trust, and under a trust heading go into irrevocable and revocable, and which of the three, or do you have a recommendation
right, okay.
for the best?
So I'm not a lawyer to know, especially I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not a lawyer in Virginia. So I can't definitively answer those questions. Generally speaking, people establish trusts as a means of keeping their estate out of probate court. It's a way of your assets being held in the trust. So if something happened to you, your trustees could manage the trust according to your wishes. In the past, people establish a trust where the trust is like a legal entity that holds your assets. And then if something happens to you, again, it says what to do with them. It used to be when the inheritance laws were different, you could avoid some inheritance tax if you structured those things in a clever way. Generally, people with very few assets would just have a will, which could just say, here's how to spend my money when I'm gone, and here's what happens to my kids. And people with more resources would lean to more towards a trust, which has certain legal advantages. Like I said, sometimes avoiding taxes, sometimes avoiding probate. But what I would say, there's a proverb that says a wise man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. So Paul even makes a reference that fathers save up for their children. And so I think there's something to be said for having an inheritance for our children. But I think when you're considering this, there are other things to keep in mind. One would be the prodigal son parable is not a model for how we should manage inheritances. You know, parables have one point, which is God is gracious to forgive repentant sinners. Don't go do what this guy did. And I've seen cases where, you know, I don't think you have to treat every one of your children equally in your estate. If you have, like I had a case many years ago, I was counseling a guy who had a lifelong struggle with drugs. When his mom died and left him the equivalent of about $150,000 in today's dollars, all he did was he had unlimited drugs for a year, and it blew his mind out, and he was schizophrenic last I talked to him. And so that's an example of a trust as well. A trust could be this guy can't manage his own money, so this relative will control the money and give him money as he needs it for necessities, but not hand him a wad of cash that he can go deal drugs with. That's another reason for a trust. Or you may have a child who's just so irresponsible, they're evil and irresponsible, you don't want them to have the money. On the other hand, you may have a child who is a missionary in Botswana or something, and you may want them to have more of the money. Another thing to consider in a trust is, I think, wise to put into the trust your church or other missions organizations that may have been depending upon you. And I've explained to my kids that when something happens to us, I have three sons, and then I have a fourth heir, which is ministries we've been involved in, and that they're going to share their inheritance with the fourth heir, and that's what we've decided to do. Those things are usually easier to set forth in a trust. But if your estate is relatively small, you can use the Costco or Intuit Willmaker, and you've got something especially for your kids in custody. If it's larger, you ought to consult an attorney who understands these things. There's a guy that is a godly man who has something called Christian Willmaker, Trustmaker. Name begins with a Z. I may remember his name. So anyway, find someone trustworthy if it's a matter where you have more you're concerned about. If we get older, it tends to be more. Mark Siebold, I think, is the guy that's created an app that is a Christian version that tries to get you to think biblically as you answer questions about what you want in a will or a trust.
Thank you for doing this. Two questions. One is about, could you talk to annuities, what you think about annuities? And the second is, if you have a need to get life insurance and you have a pre-existing health condition, that when I've gone to be screened, they say, no, they promise you these rates, you go through the whole rigmarole, right. And then they say astronomical rate because of this heart condition. So,
under point two is that insurance companies are not charities. They look at someone's situation and they say, you're this old, this is your health situation, and so there is a one in so many probability of us having to pay out $1 million, and they're going to charge enough money. Well, if there are 10,000 guys like you, they'll collect a little bit more money than they pay out. And so that's, if you want the insurance, it's a fair price to pay because you have those conditions, and you have to decide whether you can afford that or not. That's an advantage when people are younger to get insurance that will last longer. Like in my case, I would get 15 or 20 year level premium. And one thing that could happen would be, you're looking at if you could get a level premium for 20 years at this point when you're healthy. The last time I got life insurance, I got it when I was at the peak of health. had lost a bunch of weight. All my numbers looked great. And so I got the best rate. Now if I were to go back, you know, it's another matter. But as I think that's an advantage for those who are younger to, when you get it, extend the premium. Like you can get a 10-year level premium. Let's say you're paying $600 a year, or you can get a 20-year and you're paying $800 a year. But that may well be worth it because then you're guaranteeing your insurability for that long. If you're in that situation, and there are other respects, we'll all be in that situation, you have a decision to make. I'm going to get to a point where if I want to renew the insurance I have, it would be so much, it's probably not going to be worth it to me, given I have savings where I can survive. So, but that's the reality of insurance. And it used to be with health insurance. Again, they're not running charities. They want to collect 5 or 6% more money than they pay out. And if someone comes in with health conditions, it's going to be harder to get the insurance. It doesn't mean you're going to die soon, but it means if you have these conditions, out of 1,000 guys like you, they're going to have to pay out several in the next 10 years, and they don't want to, they're going to have to collect enough money to do that. And there's you may decide it's worth paying. It's hard to know. It's another incentive to save more money so you don't need the insurance. Annuities, there are all kinds of different kinds of annuities. Two bad things about annuities that can happen to you. One is that people who sell annuities often get a lot of commission selling the annuity, and so that means there's less money working for you no matter how they sell it. You know, if you give them $100,000 for the annuity, and they're different, some will then pay you such amount of money when you get older per month or year. You know, there are different structures of these annuities, but the how is the person selling you the annuity making his money? And that is that much of your money that's not going to work for you no matter how they spin it. Like you may give them $100,000 as you have a $100,000 balance, but if you take your money out after the first year, you pay a 15% penalty to take it out. Why? Because they paid him a 10% commission. And so annuities are often sold by people who make a lot of money selling the annuity, and you may be able to get something that would be equivalent or better investment without the money going to the salesman and your money being tied in, which is another factor. Your money often gets locked in to annuity. It's very expensive to take it out. Sometimes the rate of return is relatively low. Sometimes there are annuities where if you die, it stops paying. And you know, so you bought the annuity and they're going to pay you $10,000 a year out of your $100,000. Then you die after year two, you're done. In that case, they won the bet, you lost the bet. So there are some annuities that could be, some annuities that operate more or less like mutual funds that are tax avoidance. Even then, you'd want to minimize what it costs to own the annuity. They're also more expensive to own than just mutual funds. There are more fees, there's more costs incurred. So for some people, it might be a way of structuring their finances for taxes, or they've already put into their IRA what they can, and so this is something else. Or they want to guarantee a future stream of income. But interest rates have been so low that they've not paid all that well. Again, beware of annuity salesmen would be my summary comment. There may be some very wonderful ones, but I've had some bad experiences watching other people, didn't fully understand what they were buying and then regretted it. But I own one kind of annuity and I don't regret it, but it's not the kind I was just describing. It was basically a mutual fund substitute for retirement funds. When I was living in Saudi Arabia, I was making foreign money, so I couldn't put it into retirement accounts in the U.S. And so I created an annuity through Vanguard that had very low fees, but it's still not as good as their normal mutual funds. But it's essentially just a way of investing in mutual funds for me. But often they're expensive. That may be more than you wanted to know. Or it may have gone too fast that you couldn't follow it.
How's it going? How do you reconcile an example when Jesus spoke of like the rich young ruler in reference when you're speaking at the beginning of, hey, it's wealth is okay. One thing that I gather based off of everything you said is kind of in reference to like sanctification, if it's like a step process, you're going to be able to handle the wealth is what I gather, similar in nature to like a Joseph example. So how do you reconcile the example of the rich young ruler and everything else?
Jesus told the rich young ruler to sell everything you have and follow me. And so there are events in Scripture where particular calls are made to particular people that are not generic to all people at all times. And so, in the case of this rich young ruler, Jesus, knowing his heart, knowing that he was covetous, he said he wanted to be a disciple of Jesus. And by the way, general principle in counseling, I think a lot of Christians now need a lot more of what Jesus said to people when he called them to discipleship, which is, to follow me, you've got to sell out everything and follow me. That's the principle. Now, in the particular case of this person, the test of that particular person was, you say you want to follow me, or do you want to follow me so badly you'll give up everything to follow me? And not every believer has that particular call. You have all these examples of people in the New Testament. There were rich women in Luke 8 who provided for Jesus. He didn't make them give up everything. They were still rich, and they kept providing for him, and that's how God used their wealth. Paul tells in 1 Timothy 6, we began with the rich in this present world. God has given us things to enjoy. It's not wrong for you to have some wealth. Give it away. Don't trust in your riches. So this was a particular admonition to a particular man, and yet there's a principle there where if we're making money or people or a lot of other things an idol, Paul describes the conversion of the Thessalonians in chapter 1, verse 9, as you turn from idols to serve the living God. And Jesus is saying, this is your idol. Turn from that and you can follow me. And it exposed his covetousness, his idolatry. But not all of us are required to live that way. There was a particular calling, just like, you know, the people, there's a denomination, actually, the 2x2s, that when Jesus told people to go from town to town and not to carry anything with them and to trust the hospitality, that was a unique event in the ministry of Jesus where his disciples were sent out by him to extend his work in a particular way. That does not mean that the Hensons can't own a house and that just to go to your houses, I guess, and see what you'll feed them and whether you'll let them sleep there. Yes, Josh.
I was going to say, he also says in those contexts, go to the Jews and not to the Gentiles. And we wouldn't follow that today either.
Right. So, yeah. But again, I think we should live in the tension of that. It's not like say, hey, I can be rich and there's no problem. When I was in my 20s, I was suddenly making, those were my fat cow years. I earned more money in my 20s in today's dollars than like the next three decades combined. I felt the burden of what do I do with this? In light of my temptation to trust money, my covetousness, those struggles came out when you're there, and how much is enough to give away and how much is too much to keep and what lifestyle is appropriate. I have freedom because I don't have a particular call like that guy did, but there is a struggle to it. We should have a bit of tension without failing to enjoy what God has given us. Going once? Yes.
When it comes to budget making, are there certain areas that you find that people allocate more money to than they really should? Or like conversely, are there certain areas where they allocate too little money where they should be, you know, putting more in there?
Yeah, I think, I'm not sure I have an immense amount of wisdom there beyond Dave Ramsey, but I think that there are certain things that tend to leak, which is, I mean, you do Uber Eats, you stop for fast food, you buy Starbucks, and all these things you're perfectly free to do, or you sign up for a monthly charge for this. Right now with streaming, right? You've got this one and this one. You've got Disney Channel. And so you've got these little leaks, any one of which isn't that bad, but there's so many of them, and it's on auto pay. And so it's usually entertainment-type things. I mean, rent, mortgage, utilities are kind of hard to... I mean, you can turn up the air conditioning or something, but there's usually just a handful of the leeches or something or vampires that are getting you. And now, if anybody over budgeting, they usually under budget. They usually underestimate how much they're spending on certain things. I think also just planning on medical bills, car repairs, and there are guidelines they're on the internet. I have it built into my budget thing where, you know, the general wisdom is this percentage of a car's value in a given year, you need to expect for repairs, this percentage of a house value. and just to be prepared for that stuff. Yeah, I don't know if you have any particular categories you had in mind. Thanks for hanging in there. Josh, do you want me to close in prayer? Or
yeah.
Unless you have any questions?
Can you just last question?
I'm just thinking, my kids are 8 and 6, thinking about the future thing. I want them to go to college. I understand that, you know, as parents, we have freedom as to how much, if any, of our parents or our kids' education we're going to pay for. Could you just give some sapiential thoughts on pros and cons of paying for your kids for college, maybe since you've been through it, what you've learned?
Do as I say, not as I did.
Okay. Yeah.
So I'll take a step back. I think some things we did better than others. Again, our kids are now 40, 38, and 34. But I think that, you know, we would give our kids as they grew a little older, here is an amount of money for you to buy your clothes, to do your hair care, you know, at categories of life rather than asking us for money. And there was actually kind of a funny story where we had a kid who took all of his money and bought fancy shoes that he then wore in the mud and they fell apart. And he wanted more money, didn't he? That was your money. This is how that works in the real world. And I'm a runner, and I had some old shoes that had lost their cushioning, but they still were held together. They stunk, but they would have been two sizes too big. You can wear these until you save up enough money to buy the next pair of shoes. And instead of buying the $120 whatever it is shoe that fell apart, he bought the $20 Target shoes. And so I think you can teach your kids a lot about budgeting and the correspondence between work and having what they want and try to make those connections. Different kids are wired different ways, and so we did it the same way with all three, and it hit with two and not the third. I think the education part, there's something in our culture that almost says you drive yourself deeply into debt just to get your kid a college degree, and every family has a different situation. We know people that have used things like ROTC. They've used a community college to get stuff out of the way cheaply. So I think you look at your situation and what you can afford, what your kids' abilities are. Not every kid should go to college. Some kids would do great to learn a trade, and they may be, I know people who are electricians and plumbers who make a lot more money than the average college graduate. So I think you work with them. You know, we had kids who were National Merit Scholars who were offered significant scholarships to pretty high-level schools, and yet they needed money from us to make it happen, and we used some of our money from Saudi Arabia to have that happen, which was a decision we made that may or may not have been I think we were free to make the decision. So I think the idea of taking all the equity out of your house and wiping out your retirement savings so your kid can go to a private college and learn liberal arts degree, again, if you want to do that, you can, but it's probably not a wise financial decision. So it's back to, it's calculus. You've got all these different factors. What is your kid good at? What are his opportunities, her opportunities? What are your resources? And then there can be cases where you say, my kid is exceptionally gifted, or I highly value, I want my kid to go to master's. And it's so important to me, and I so highly value what they're doing, I'm willing to draw down my retirement or my home equity to do that. I can't tell you you're sinning to do that. Just go in with your eyes open and realizing that some kids go to master's and flame out. And you've got to love your kid even if that happens. And beware of getting into a lot of debt or them in a lot of debt, especially for a degree that won't produce the income to pay it off. But it's all freedom. But some people may, you know, debt equals more risk for the future, and sometimes the payoff isn't there. But the payoff may be there for you in a particular circumstance. You may really want your daughter to go to master's because you know that's where all the good husbands are. And if you end up dropping $50,000 or $60,000 out of your home equity to, along with the scholarship she gets because she, you know, was a very promising student or she's a great soccer player or something, your values may say, that's how I want to spend that money. And you're free to do that, and you're free to say, sorry, we can't do that. And when she's looking at you with her puppy eyes, saying, my dream all my life has been to go here, it's going to be hard to say no. Says me. Not with a daughter, but something like that. Let me pray. Father in heaven, we thank you for how you've richly blessed us with material things beyond what we need, and with wisdom in your word, that your word truly is sufficient to equip us for every good work, including our vocations, our spending, our saving, our giving, our preparations for the future. I thank you for my brothers and my sisters who have taken time out of their day to be together because they want to learn more of what you have to say. And I pray that as your word has been read and explained, that they would hear your voice. I thank you that where we have fallen short, there is mercy, as we read even, and we sang in Psalm 103, that you have compassion upon us, for we are but dust. We are weak, and you care for us. You forgive us our sins, and you put them away as far as the east is from the west. And so thank you for your mercy to us, that you do not treat us as we deserve, even for sins and mistakes and unwise dealings. Yet help us to honor you in our labor, our spending, our saving, our giving. We thank you for Christ, who gave all for us. We pray in his name. Amen.